Merlane was rapidly tiring of the games. Children's games were, after all, of only limited interest to real children. They were mostly the adults' idea of what children should enjoy. She had beaten Kildim and Kildee and even Charles without difficulty. The teacher had beamed at her and called her a little natural, but she didn't care. It was all so easy to know what cards were coming up, and, in fact, she didn't hardly have to cheat. She wondered whether Charles had known she mind-peaked. Had he mind-peaked himself? The teacher didn't know. In fact, she had made sure of this. Kildim and Kildee were just too dumb to know.
That concludes our precog series.
Sally's smile was nice, but Merlane had peeked a little too deeply and knew that at times she thought naughty. That young man Warlock, who went around without clothes and some pretty good male contours, really flamed an instinct Merlane would not encounter in herself for years.
Oh, Sally, I was wondering if we could have lunch together.
Sally's pulse leaped so high it almost made Merlane wince, but she affected indifference.
Oh, of course, Frederick.
And a talk in the bar. And then maybe during your off time a visit to her room and then...
Merlane. I'm sorry, but she's a natural.
You're not sorry at all.
Chimera. They have to be the ones.
You think?
I know. Helba brought them, didn't she?
Oh. Oh, dear.
So they can read minds. We're both practitioners of the art. And adult.
Yes. Yes, that is true.
You can go at it now and we won't tell anyone, will we?
Merlane looked around at her brother and the nominal kings. Kildim and Kildee were clearly puzzled, but Charles had his head bobbing and an expression to go with the way Sally felt. Guilty desire.
I know you both want to.
Young lady, didn't they teach you anything?
I was told not to peek. I don't usually
But you did.
Uh-huh. Because it's interesting.
Merlane, what happens or doesn't happen between grown-ups is none of your concern.
That's what Mama says.
You won't do it again? Not ever again? At least during your stay here.
No.
Frederick looked the blonde straight in her blue eyes.
Well?
They have things to do, and it's not as if they're unsupervised. Oh, here comes that girl who was here.
Auntie John!
John stood alone where she had been earlier. She had some packages, possibly presents. Merlane didn't try to stop herself. She just had to peek. Auntie John was thinking something about two pearl drops put into a chocobola shared by Sally and Frederick. Then, Aunt John's thoughts got dark and ugly and then blank. Never before had she experienced this mental shutout. Auntie John was smiling a smile that was not a smile at all under the surface, and that suggested she was going to punish her for peeking. But Auntie said nothing of the kind. Her thoughts were now hidden.
Oh, come, Sally.
Oh, yes, Frederick.
The two of them walked away as if guided by some unheard instruction, arms circling each other's waists. Their passion tempted Merlane not at all now, though a moment before it had been weaker and she had been far more interested. That was odd. Even if she had wanted to break her promise, there was now Auntie. There was fire in the eyes that were usually mischievous. It held Merlane, preventing her from diverting or dividing her attention.
This is for you.
Auntie John placed a package in her hands. The wrapping felt smooth, almost like skin.
And for you?
She placed a similar package into the hands of a red-haired king.
Can we open them now?
That would be unwise. You must not let adults or even children see you try these on.
Oh, then it was the clothes. That was the glaring exception to the law. Clothing was almost never interesting, especially if an adult picked it out.
You're going to have fun with these.
Auntie John made a sweeping gesture with her hand that completely circled them.
There. Now no one will hear or see, and you may try.
Merlane hadn't realized that Auntie John could do that kind of magic. Hurriedly, they ripped open their packages. The strings, so much like dried guts, came untied without Merlane doing any picking. Magic indeed. The skin, yes. It definitely felt more like skin than paper, and looked it too, peeled back from her fingers. She held in her two outstretched arms nothing. The twin, who was either Kildim or Kildee, she couldn't tell without peeking into his mind, because she had forgotten which mirror image was which, was standing exactly as she was, as if Auntie John had commanded it. He was similarly baffled.
There are two cloaks in each package, one for each of you. Put them on.
Merlaine felt gingerly in the nothingness. She found substance after all. Almost without willing herself to, she took hold of what her fingers touched and lifted it. It was very, very light, with no texture feel at all. Only the slightest resistance of it against her fingers satisfied her that it was even there.
Be careful not to drop them. They can be difficult to find.
Ignoring Auntie and the rest, Merlaine felt out the lines of a cloak. When she put her hands and arms under it, they vanished. This was a magic cloak. She whipped it up and drew it around her shoulders. She felt the same, but now she couldn't see herself. Could anyone else?
Merlaine, you are now invisible. You can go anywhere and not be seen. Even witches and warlocks won't see you. But you will have to be quiet, lest they hear you.
Oh, Auntie! Auntie!
You can go right into people's rooms. You can take their things without their knowing.
The kinglets and Charles were now donning their cloaks. Charles left his head uncovered so that it appeared to float in the air. Then he drew the cloak all the way up so that his face seemed to disappear into some invisible hole from the bottom to the top. Kildim and Kildy put theirs on from the top of the head down. Their bodies seemed first decapitated, then cut off at the chests, waists, and legs, until only their 4 feet were standing, and then nothing. No one now seemed to be present, except Auntie.
Take things?
Of course. Taking is fun. At this convention, there are many, many magical things that you can enjoy without anyone catching you. Books that tell secrets. Elixirs that make people do things and behave in different ways. Love potions can be really fun. And hate potions, even more fun. Especially when you slip one to one member of a couple and the other to the other. Toys that you'd never, never get to play with without your cloaks. You can play tricks on people and never get caught. Not as long as you are careful and quiet. You can see things children are forbidden to see.
Like what Sally and Frederick are doing?
Exactly like that.
Tricks? You mean like kicking butts? Pinching? Fun things like that?
Oh, yes, yes. I see you do have a quick imagination. Only you must not allow people to know you're there. If they realize, they will use magic on you and then you will be caught and punished.
Elba would box our ears. Or spank our butts. Maybe take our cloaks away.
Possibly worse. Remember, this is not your home. If you're caught in mischief here, there's no telling what your punishment may be. Any people you hurt here will enjoy hurting you more than you enjoyed hurting them.
But hurting people is wrong.
Pooh.
What should we do first?
Go back where we had lunch and get chocobolas.
Yes, let's. Maybe we better join hands. We don't want to get separated or lost. We can't talk where anyone might hear us.
That's an excellent suggestion, Charles. I can see you have an aptitude for this. You children run along. Have fun. Be naughty. Auntie John is going to be doing some naughty things herself.
Like with that hunk.
Perhaps. We shall see. Bye.
Let's go.
It was later in the day, after they had seen many things the children weren't supposed to, that they decided to revisit the hawker's room.
We haven't stolen anything yet. The stuff we ate and drank wasn't important. We need to steal something valuable that will be missed.
Yes, watching the old woman in the bathroom wasn't much fun. And Frederick and Zally were just laying there, hardly moving at all. What's the fun in that? We have to do something.
Merlaine felt less than enthusiastic. She had managed to dissuade the kings from pinching women's bottoms because that would have led to an instant clamor that could have resulted in them all getting caught. But watching things without interfering wasn't much fun either. Also, she had guzzled one big chocobola too many and gobbled one too rich dessert more than her tummy wanted to handle. Now she wanted more than anything to go back to the lavatory, lest she do something truly spectacular right where she stood. Maybe she could wait a little longer.
A lot of people in here. Don't stumble against anyone. Don't get caught.
I've an idea.
Let's let go of each other's hands. We'll each take something, hide it under our cloaks, and then get together in that room we were in.
Great idea, Kildum! I know, because I thought of it first. Once we're together in the room, we'll see what each of us got.
I think I'd rather take something from one of the other rooms.
Me too.
But we'll each go to a different room. Kildum, Kildy, you can start your stealing here if you like. Or if you want, you can go steal somewhere else.
I'm going back to the kitchen. I'm hungry.
Merlane followed a pretty dark-haired witch into the lavatory and did what was proper. It was a great relief. No one saw her, she felt. But when the witch closed off the running water before Merlane had her hands washed, she was annoyed. So as the witch walked away, Merlane stuck out a foot and tripped her.
Oh! So, Chrissy, you are jealous. Two can play at that. Just you wait until I get my spellbook. You'll be sorry you did that.
For the moment, the lavatory was empty. Merlane went to the sink and turned on the water herself and washed her hands. She waited patiently by the door until another witch entered, then went out, catching the swing of the door at just the right place. Down the hotel corridor was the one who had left. The dark-haired witch was quite recognizable because of her shoulder-length glassy hair and alabaster bottom. The witch's back was very straight, and there was no question that she was angry. Merlane decided to follow her. She did. Up one corridor, down another, and to a room with a number on it. The witch made a short, angry clearing pass with her hand before going inside. Merlane followed right after her. The witch went straight for the wooden dresser on which was cluttered a lot of stuff. There were unguents, powders, creams, gels, and potions. The witch hesitated over these, picked up a large stoppered bottle, then set it back down. She opened a drawer, took out a large leather-bound book, and flipped through its pages.
This will do nicely.
Merlane was alone with an array of stuff used by witches. She should take something. It was only right that she fulfill Auntie John's faith in her. But what? She picked up the bottle the dark-haired witch had hesitated over. It had a label.
Alice water.
Alice water? Alice water? Where had she heard of that? There had been a girl named Alice in a book. What was it called? Alice in the Appleberry Patch, Alice and the Squirbits. Close, close, but not quite. Then she remembered it. It hadn't been Alice anything, though it had been about Alice. Down the Squirbit Hole. It had been about an ordinary girl with pointed ears who couldn't mind peek. There had been a bottle in it labeled Drink Me. Take a drink from the bottle, and it made you big or it made you tiny. Nice story. And now here was something that reminded her of it. Just possibly a drink from the bottle would make her big or small. But which?
Oh, no!
Merlane opened her cloak and pulled the bottle out of sight. She'd just barely gotten the bottle under her cloak, and the cloak closed when the witch was at the dresser.
That'll fix her. See how she likes having all her hair fall out. Steal my warlock, will she?
Steal her warlock? All Merlane had done was trip her. There must be an ongoing feud, and the tripping was taken as a reminder of it. Merlane had been lucky. Maybe. The witch put the book back in the drawer. She looked at the contents of the dresser and saw that the Alice water bottle was gone.
So you got in here, did you, Chrissy? You're going to regret that. Last time I borrow anything from you, I hope you drink the entire bottle. I hope it changes you so much you'll never get back to your normal size. Assuming anything about you is normal, ha ha.
The witch started circling the room, feeling with her hands as though for someone invisible. Merlane moved back and aside, keeping the witch's hands from touching her. Once, the witch reached right over her, almost touching her head. It really wasn't hard remaining clear, but Merlane was afraid her beating heart would give her away with its thumping. All she had to do was keep her nerve, but she wasn't sure of her supply of nerve right now. Abruptly, the witch gave up in disgust and went out. Merlane followed in her steps. The witch turned left, Merlane turned right. In a moment, she was clear. Charles felt as if he were being led. He couldn't have explained it, but his invisible feet had carried him right to this door. Something just made him want to come this way. He opened the door and went in. For a moment, he was disappointed. It was just a room, not much different than their own. There wasn't a lot of baggage scattered about, let alone magical paraphernalia. It was more like a storage chamber for the convention, with boxes of props and things. He was wasting his time here. What stupid whim had led him to this washout? Then his eyes fell on the bed and on the small weapon lying across it. It was a short dragon letter scabbard with jewels on it, and protruding from its widest end was the jeweled pommel of a sword. On the pommel, worked into the precious metal, was a design of a shining sun wearing a smiling face. It was beautiful to look at, and right away, he wanted it. He picked it up in both hands as gently as if it were alive. The blade shone as if held in bright sunlight. It was beautiful, this sword, and just his size. It was probably part of someone's costume for a play, a child's role. Everything had to look authentic. A hero prince. He bent over the blade, studying it, testing its sharp edge with a careful touch of his thumb. He glanced at the dresser mirror. There, looking cutely forlorn, was a little girl in a nightdress. It seemed as if she were getting ready for bed. She had long, light hair that glowed as he looked at it, blue eyes soft with tears. She was astonishingly pretty. For a moment, the ghost, or whatever she was, looked at him from the glass. Then, in the manner a spent candle guttered, dimmed, and went out, she faded. The mirror was just a glass. It reflected the room with the sword and the scabbard apparently floating in midair. Charles mentally shook himself. The girl wasn't scary at all. Still, it was a warning of sorts. He had best take the weapon and go. He put the sheathed sword under his invisibility cloak and made certain he could not see it in the mirror and that his hands and feet did not show. Weren't Merlane and the Paynes going to be surprised when he showed them what he had found? In the room, the redhead Kildee had a book. Its title was Spells, and it had a cover that felt like the wrappings on their cloaks, peeled human skin. On the first page was a warning.
Adepts only. With this, we can do magic. That's what it's for. Helba had a book of spells, but it doesn't have these pictures.
Merlane and Charles looked at the pictures. They were gross. Did witches really do things like that? She had never suspected. Butchering babies, pulling out people's guts, chewing on people's parts.
I've got another.
Kildum took it out from the cloak, now lying invisibly on a chair with no apparent bottom. It was a book, but it didn't have the same cover as his brother's. This one was titled Opal.
Opal's a girl's name.
Wrong. It's a gem. A very magical stone with very special powers. With it, anyone, you don't have to be a witch or a warlock, can go anywhere in an instant, even into another frame. We could go home if we wanted to, kick some butts, and then disappear back to here.
Just by wanting to? Without a transporter?
Yeah, and look here. This is who has it.
Charles squinted at the picture. The pictures were prettier than those in the other book, Merlane decided, but not by much. This one showed a creature resembling both man and fish. It showed a fish's scales, fins, and eyes, and a man's arms, legs, nose, and forehead. It was a giant, judging from the trees that came to its scaly elbows. Maybe they were small trees. Still, it was scary. There were gills on its throat and broad greenish nostrils. It was crying out something and brandishing a club that dangled tree roots from the giant's greenish hand.
Ugh! What do you call that thing? It sure isn't human.
It's an orc. You babies are really dumb, aren't you? Nobody teaches you anything.
What did you get, Charles?
This?
Charles, don't kill him!
Why not? He insulted us.
He's a king. They're both kings. Paynes and brats, but also kings. Helba wouldn't give us presents if we hurt the kinglets.
Yeah, you're right. I wasn't going to anyway.
The blade gleamed, and though it could have been used by a grown man, it was as if it had been made for a person of Charles' size. It was a small weapon, but definitely a real one.
That's a sword! Is it magic?
I don't know. I just took it from the room I was in. There seemed to be magic there, like someone watching, but it didn't stop me.
The kinglet reached out and grabbed his brother by a lock of red hair. He pulled out one of the hairs.
I have to test the edge.
Kildee held the hair between thumb and forefinger at either end. Slowly, respectfully, he brought the middle of the hair against the edge. With no apparent pressure, the hair parted. It hardly seemed to touch the blade. It fell in two parts.
Sharp! What are you going to do with it?
Don't say it, Charles. Don't tell him you're gonna ram it up his...
I wasn't going to. You think I'm as dumb as they? I'm going to wear it when I can. Take it home if I can. Slay a bandit with it, maybe.
You slay a bandit?
Or assist Dragon Horus with his lunch.
Now that I want to see, your Dragon Horus.
You will when we're back. I'll show you. Maybe feed you to him, too.
You wouldn't!
Nah. You know what a delicate gizzard Dragon Horus has. Raw meat is one thing, but rotten meat is another.
Don't even think that way. We have to get along with the kinglets. It's been a long time since they fed us those laxaberries. Besides, I told Helba every naughty thing they did until Mama and Daddy made me stop. We got our revenge.
I still don't like them.
They know better than to play king with us. After Helba made them eat all those naughty words they'd written, they were sicker than us.
I made them feel even sicker when they vomited.
You did? That was brilliant, Charles. I never even thought of that.
Copperhaired girls can't think as well as copperhead boys.
This was getting out of hand. She used her flattery judiciously, but he was believing it.
You start calling me Sister Wart the way Daddy does Auntie John, and you'll get the point.
Truce. I won't think that again. Not to you, anyway.
Truce.
Why are you two looking at each other like that?
Charles shrugged. Merlaine smiled in the manner she knew adults loved.
That orc. What's it doing with the opal?
The orc is king of Arpal, the water country right next to the kingdom of Rottenick. There are other orcs, but mostly in different frames. Arpal's king is Brutalus.
What a silly name.
What'd you get?
She showed him the bottle of Alice water. The other two were immediately unimpressed.
Perfume? Toilet water?
It's obviously a potion. They can be anything from love to poison. Let's get back to the children's suite before we're missed.
It was such an obvious suggestion that each of them put on a cloak. Merlaine, though she now felt embarrassed about it, carefully retained the bottle of Alice water and held on to it on the way back. Back in the children's suite, they found their old corner and removed their cloaks. No one seemed to have missed them. They had led a charmed life, perhaps literally, for the past hour.
What do you think, Kildum?
I don't know, Kildee. I think these two are in trouble.
Us?
She's your aunt. She's the one who gave us the cloaks.
You're the one who kicked butts and pinched bottoms.
I pinched people. Kildee kicked them. We're not in trouble. We're kings.
In an evil eye.
Just as if he had become a warrior grown, Charles drew his sword.
Charles,
I just want to remind them. They don't get by with that king stuff with us.
Why, children?
Auntie materialized right in front of them with a sudden sweep of cloak.
Whatever is the matter?
They all told her at once, each accusing all the others and protesting his or her own innocence.
Oh, pish tosh. All you sweet, dear little children have to do is do something for the others that is particularly nice. Then they'll forgive you your transgressions. Otherwise, the least they'll do is send you home, probably with your little posteriors steaming.
But what can we do? We're really in trouble, and maybe you are too.
Oh, my dear, your auntie is much more durable than you. Here, Kildee, let me have your spelling book.
Reluctantly, the kinglet handed it over. John's fingers opened the book to a picture and showed it to them. The picture was of a little girl clothed in flames. Mean-looking wizards and warlocks and witches were dancing around the girl, laughing cruelly.
See what can happen when you steal and get caught?
They won't burn us!
Don't be too certain. Naughty children have to be dealt with.
That's why there's a children's suite.
But how can we...
Auntie ignored him and stretched out a hand to Kildee.
Now let me have your book, Kildum, the Orc text.
The kinglet handed her the book. She returned the spell book to his brother.
Now here is the opal, the magical jewel that makes travel between frames as easy as thought. Don't you think Helba would be pleased if you could get it for her?
The orc has it.
Oh, piddle on the orc. It's nothing but a big, clumsy old fish shaped like a man. Hit it with a few spells and it won't be a bother. Besides, all you have to do is get the opal without getting caught.
But...
You are most unusual children. All of you. Melaine, Charles, you have special powers. You can use them against the orc while you steal his opal. Nobody will know until afterward. And then they'll call you clever.
Isn't opal a long way off? Even at home?
Oh, not with spells, dear child. Once at home, you can fly.
But we can't fly. We can't even become swooshes the way you and Kildum and Kildee and Helba did.
A detail, I assure you. Imagine how pleased Helba's going to be on your return.
But I'm just a girl.
And your companions are just boys. An obvious liability, I agree. But you do have your loving auntie.
You'll come with us?
Partway. Until you're home and started on your way for Apple. Come now.
Wearing their invisibility cloaks, they followed a group of conventioneers out of the hotel. There, unknown to the young witches, the children joined them on a platform for the ride and exited with them at the terminal. With a few whispered words from John, they wormed their way through the crowd to a vacant transporter. They waited until a neighboring transporter booth was empty as well, then Auntie John set the controls on both. Kildum and Kildee went into the first transporter. Their destination was the underwater installation of the Point Ears. Merlaine and Charles entered the second. Then they were there, in the installation chamber they had used with their parents. Here, alone except for the Muvar book and parchment, they were to await Auntie John's help.
Do you think she'll do it?
She said she would.
They waited, and they waited, and they waited some more. Just as Merlaine was getting ready to cry and Charles was trying to find some manly way to avoid doing something similar, the three waterbirds flew squawking down the river. Merlaine herself was flapping her wings and flying away from the chamber to her surprise, and with her was a young swooshling who had to be her brother. The old woman stared with incomprehension at the somehow familiar clothes hanging on the wall of the store's dressing room. Greenbrier pantaloons and brownberry shirt, where had she heard of these? Her own clothes were dark and none too clean. Her face, in the mirror, was unbelievably ugly, all nose and warts and sunken eyes. She was an old, old hag, the utmost crone, and she smelled bad even to herself. Worse, she had no memory of who she was or how she had come to be here. The clothes on the hanger were almost certainly those of a young person. Had she come in here to try them on? Was that what she was doing? Shopping? But then, why wasn't she clean? Certainly any woman bathed before shopping for clothes. Had she any money? Could she buy any of these things? Carefully, slowly, because her joints and bones caused her pain, she stripped off the black sack-like dress. There was something hanging beside the clothing, a pouch of stones and a leather sling. She took these items down, fondled them, and knew somehow that these were hers and hers alone. She put them back and tackled the clothes. She put on the underclothes first. They were clean and modest and a reasonable fit. Now, feeling a little better about it, she stuck her skinny arms into the sleeves of the brownberry shirt and pulled it on. She reached for the sling and pouches of stones. She hung them under her left arm. She looked in the mirror at herself. A crone with ugly facial hair and warts, now dressed as a rustic visitor from a faraway land. She had to get out of here. Once she was out in the store, someone would recognize her. There would be help for her, from the salespeople if from no one else. Taking a firm resolve, she left the dressing room and emerged into a busy togging shop for females. There were young and old folk feeling dresses and underthings. Birds swooped overhead, now and then landing and changing instantly into sales clerks. Wings whispered behind her. She turned, and there was the clerk she had been hoping for. Broad of shoulders, handsome as anything, he would have been a dream of what a young girl traditionally longed for. Why she should think of him that way wasn't clear.
What, madam, are you doing here?
Shopping.
Shopping? May I ask for what?
Clothes.
Frankly, I can see why. Do you have anything in mind?
No, I have nothing in my mind.
Do you have credit?
Credit for what?
An account with the store to pay for your clothes.
I have to pay for these.
Those are not ours. Those must be what you were wearing when you came into our store. What money do you have?
Money? I probably had a purse.
Probably.
Just then a white dove landed and became a lady sales clerk. The young lady looked at her, eyes widening.
She's dressed like that other, the young woman who was here.
The young woman was with this one?
No, the young one was with two others. I've never seen this one before.
Could she have a purse?
I'll check.
The girl made a pass, snapped a small capsule under her own nose.
No purse belonging to this woman.
People?
No people of hers here. I don't know how she can be in the store, frankly.
She's not going to be for long. Back entrance, not the front.
Right.
The sales girl made a pass with her hand. Before she realized it, the old woman was standing in a grimy alley. Magician laborers were unloading platforms at an unloading dock and floating their cargoes inside the store. She watched them for a while. No one paid any attention to her. Then one of the laborers took a break from levitating racks of clothing up a shaft. He turned and spoke.
They throw you out, mother?
Yes.
Store's all heart. No money, no business you're being here.
That's what the clerk said.
It's their business. Can't fault it. Do you know where you are?
Outside. Not in the store.
Right. Privileged streets that way. Underprivileged street the other way. If you have any friends in the city, don't go on underprivileged. Mainly failures and bad people live there.
I haven't money, and I haven't friends. That means I'm a failure. Maybe on underprivileged, I can find out why.
Luck to you, mother.
Another platform slid into place.
Well, back to work.
She watched for a little while longer, then she walked past him on her way to underprivileged. There, if anywhere, might be the answer she needed, but did not know how to seek. Sean Riley, familiarly known as St. Helens because of his volcanic nature, was playing chess with Lester Crumb. They had set up their game well within sight of the ruins of Rudd's one-time capital palace. Only one day had gone by, and already Lester was missing his feisty wife.
You know, Les, you could have gone with her.
I could have. She told me over and over. I said no. I don't want nothing to do with witches.
But she was an apprentice. Sort of. Helba and the Round Ear couldn't have done without her. She conked Zoanna with a rock so that it was possible for them to nab her.
I still don't like witches. Oh, Helba's nice enough, I guess. But she looks exactly the way Melba looked.
Don't mean she's evil. There's probably an evil man that looks like you in another frame.
I'd prefer a world without magic.
You wouldn't. I've lived in such a place.
Earth. But from the stories you've told, there was magic. Horseless carriages, talking boxes with images of living people in them, flying machines, have atom bombs.
That's atom bombs. Nuclear fission.
New clear fishing?
Not exactly.
Pfft, magic.
All science. Where your wife is now, they probably have the same things, only they work by magic. I don't pretend to understand the difference. The commander, John Knight, and I used to discuss it, but even we couldn't come to decisions. Now me, I'd have liked to have gone along into that other frame. Unfortunately, no one invited me.
You aren't married to a Helba helper.
No, but my little girl's married to the Round Ear, has children by him.
With the help of a chimera. John was there, remember?
Yes, yes, I know. But they're still his and Helm's. The magic of the chimera saved the kids' lives and allowed them to be born. The fact that they've got coppery hair is just coincidence.
and the dragon?
Helen says it never happened.
John says it did. I believe my wife.
St. Helens moved a knight. He'd beat Lester in about 2 moves. The lad had some ability, but he just wasn't concentrating.
Look there! Swooshes!
St. Helens looked where Lester was pointing, his own concentration pulled from the board. There were the swooshes, flying up and out of the ruins. 4 young ones, scarcely old enough to fly, and 1 adult swoosh of an unusual dark color and a Buzzfold's ugliness.
Do you think...
Could be, but so soon. Of course, there is the river, though even swooshes generally don't go underground.
The birds saw them, came close, and circled above their heads. The little swooshes dived down. The big swoosh blocked them, trying to indicate with a toss of its head that they should fly on. Some hesitated, but one of the little ones landed and promptly, magically, transformed.
Merlaine, what are you doing here?
Oh, St. Helens, Uncle Lester! We're on our way to get the magical opal the orc has. We're going to steal it and take it back to Helba as a gift.
You're what? You can't do that. Opal's a long way off. The orc is dangerous and stealing's not even nice.
Oh, Grandpa, you're funny. That's Auntie John squawking up there. She got us a magic cloak so the orc won't see us, and she learned from Helba how to change us into birds. We can fly there, steal the opal and...
No, you can't. It's crazy. Your mother and father would never allow...
They don't know about it. Just as you always said, what they don't know won't hurt them. It's a surprise!
The big bird flew low. Lester reached his arms out, as if expecting his wife to fly into them and receive his embrace. The bird rose slightly and just skimmed his head. A dropping fell and splattered on his upturned face.
Oh, John! I knew you were mad at me when you left, but not this mad! Come down and we'll talk.
Mad at you. Mad at you. Go home. Come, Merlaine, come. Follow us.
Merlaine was again a bird, and she quickly flew away to join the others. Lester finished wiping bird excrement onto a rag.
What do you think, St. Helens?
I think John's one hell of a girl.
I mean about this business of...
I think if they get to Opal, there'll be another stage of the prophecy.
War with Opal.
If they get the gem. Gods, how could there fail to be war?
But they can't get the opal, regardless of what she said.
If they don't, but they do get close, there still could be trouble. Those orcs aren't exactly pupkits. I just don't understand John aiding them in this. It must be her idea. She's the adult and she found the magic.
Yeah. If that big bird is really her.
Who else could it be? It can't be Helba. She'd never have shat on you, even if you made her mad.
Well, I don't think my wife would have either. St. Helens, I think that was an imposter. And I think it's leading astray my niece and nephew, your grandkids.
Dragon Horace lifted his fine, coppery snout from the mess of maggots festooning the carcass of a mere he was feeding on. There was a strange thought in his head, that head that seldom thought of anything but eating and eliminating.
Your sister, Merlaine!
There was a pesty, snoopy bird flying just below the carcass.
No, Dragon Horse, it's me! I'm the bird!
The bird lit on the tip of one of the mere's antlers. Its long beak and beady eyes were directed at him. If it wasn't Merlaine, it was a really careless bird.
Dragon Horse, Charles and I are going on a trip with those terrible twins I told you about. You know, the royal nothings with the crowns on their heads. Auntie John is along, too. It's an adventure. There's this big monster in a place called Opal who has this wonderful magical gem. We're to steal it and take it back to Helba. That will make Helba happy, and she won't punish us for all the naughty things we let the royal brats get away with. It's gonna be such fun. I wish you could come, Horace. But I don't know how to make you fly. Besides, I don't have an invisibility cloak for you.
Merlaine, come!
Horace stifled an impulse to jerk his head high and snap his jaws at the big, ugly bird.
That's Auntie John, Horace. She's impatient. Goodbye!
Horace watched the bird fly. It followed the big bird and was joined there by 3 the same size as herself. Strange. The doings of humans were incomprehensible, even if 2 of them were his siblings. They flew all day, buoyed by magic, until Merlaine's wings were tired. She knew she should be enjoying the view, as she seldom had such a chance to see the mountains, valleys, plains, and rivers from such vantage. And they were beautiful, and ugly, and shades of in-between. But mainly, she just had to concentrate on pumping her wings and keeping the pace. As night threatened, they landed on a cleared area at the extreme edge of the twin kingdoms of Klingland and Kantz. Here was glowing moss and a large gray stone bearing a pointing arrow and the dark warning, Rottenik. As they touched ground, they reverted to their natural states.
You will cross the border tomorrow in the morning. You will travel on across Rottenik to the kingdom of Apel. It will be a long journey and dangerous. You will have to use your magic and your wits.
But your magic and wits should protect us, Auntie.
Auntie John will not be going with you.
But you said...
I said you would get the opal. You children, not Auntie John. What good would it do if I got the stone for you? Well, then the credit would be mine, and you would have nothing to redeem yourselves. You must do all of this entirely by yourselves.
But...
Auntie John looked at the kinglets. Her eyes blazed. It was as if flames flicked within them. They shut up. Auntie John made a pass with her hand, and a cloud of smoke puffed into existence. In a moment, it dissipated, and there was a banquet prepared for them. Bodies of icy cold chocobola and pigel butter sandwiches that made the three boys forget about any questions they might have had, and Merlaine almost forgot. They ate, and it was delicious.
Tomorrow, you children are on your own.
But we can't become birds. You do that for us. We don't know how. We have a long way to go, and we won't get there if we can't fly.
Kildum, you have your book of spells. Merlaine, you have your Alice water. Charles, you have your magic sword.
Yes?
Merlaine tried again to penetrate Auntie John's mind and found none of her thoughts accessible. The woman had become like another person. No longer the fun-loving aunt who had been really more like another child than the sister of a parent. This showed how treacherous it was to trust the nature of adults.
But...
You, children, haven't experienced anything.
Auntie John clapped her hands, and at the smack of the palms, Kildum and Kildee fell over as if dead. Then Charles rolled his eyes upward.
Auntie John, you shouldn't have...
He was standing knee-deep in a pool of crimson. It was blood. No, it wasn't blood. It was tall red grass, and it was this color simply because of the light of the rising sun. There were feathery pink stalks to these grasses, and they waved in a cooling breeze coming across an open grassland. There was a horse under him, though a moment before this he had been standing. It was a big, firm war horse of magnificent chestnut brown. Charles now filled the big saddle. A man grown, he held a sword, and it was his sword, grown large enough to fit a warrior's hand. The horse carried him for days, possibly for years. He realized that this was not exactly reality as he knew it, though it did not seem exactly like a dream either. It was interesting, so he had no objection. He saw many sights and fought many a fight using his sword, which did indeed seem to be enchanted. It wasn't that it moved for him, but that it was so compatible that he knew how to guide it to the proper spot. He was highly competent with it because it seemed like a close friend, so he slew many orcs and many bad men, knowing that they were like fantasy figures in a game, there only to challenge him. When they died, they did not suffer. They were merely pieces being removed. Back on the plain, he found the sun still shining, and it even seemed to have a human face. His sword was no longer in his hand, not because he had been disarmed, but because he had no need for it now. Before him was a little girl in a flimsy nightdress. She had light hair and blue eyes, and she glowed just when he looked at her.
Did you enjoy it?
Enjoy what? The riding? The fights?
All.
Yes, very much. It was a good adventure, and I was a hero, I think.
Would you like to play?
Who are you?
I am Glow.
Glow? As in light? That's not a name.
It's a witch's name. It can mean goodness.
You're a witch?
My mama was.
A good witch?
Of course.
Are you dead?
Does it matter to you?
No.
She set her little fists on her narrow hips.
You want to play or not?
Yes. What game, Glow?
Hide and seek, then.
There was a forest around them, instead of the sunny plain with the red grass. It was all right. She ran away from him, her hair flying back behind her, her nightdress flapping in the breeze of her motion. He ran after her. She stayed just ahead, going down a long path. She ducked in and out behind great trees and many bushes. He would gain on her and almost touch her, and then she'd be far ahead.
You can't catch me.
She must know the magic of this place, so she could jump ahead without seeming to. That was all right. It made the game more challenging. A cottage was ahead. Now Glow was at his side, holding his hand. Either he had caught her or she had changed the game. It didn't matter. It was fun to be with her. Flowers bordered their path, smelling sweet, looking pretty, sissy, but nice. The door of the cottage was open, and together they walked through it and inside the cottage.
I love you, Glow.
He was unsurprised even at this sudden declaration. What he meant was that he loved being with her, playing games with her, and even holding her hand. She was just so perfectly right for him that it could not be otherwise, even if she was dead. She hadn't quite said about that, but either she was dead or alive, and he could accept it either way, just so long as he could be with her in his dreams.
I love you too, Charles.
I want to marry you.
But how could he do that if she was dead? What did he know of marriage if she was alive? Maybe he was lucky this was only a dream.
Well, you can't if I'm not alive.
Then it matters?
Not if you forget me.
Will I forget?
Do you want to?
No!
It's only a dream. You'll forget.
Never!
Charles, if you do remember, remember to be good.
I am good.
Not always. Lately, you've been bad.
How bad?
Stealing is bad. You know that.
Then I won't steal again.
Even the opal?
The opal? Yes, the opal. I have to steal that. But after that, I'll do what is right. I promise.
You must not steal the opal, Charles.
The opal's magic. Magic should belong to everyone. At least that's what my aunt says.
That isn't your aunt, Charles. Your aunt isn't evil. The person telling you to steal is bad. Witch bad. I am in a position to know. Do not obey her, Charles, please.
Then the little girl named Glow grew shimmery and hazy. As before, like a light from a candle that has guttered out, she was there, and then she was gone.
Glow!
The old woman was hungry. She had walked a long way, and her bones ached and her head hurt. She still did not know who she was or how she had come to be in this city. She felt as if her body were not really hers, and that this was not a city she had lived in. Was she human? That seemed likely. What sort of human? She couldn't know or think. She was here, and that was an end of it, except for a faint cloud of doubt and confusion that impinged on the dubious clarity of her thoughts. The smell was coming from a diner. She peered at and into it. Dirty windows, ragged customers seated at a counter. The word on the window was Jake's. It wasn't appetizing on the whole, but neither was she. The unkempt man frying patties of meat ignored her. A counterwoman came up to her.
You want something?
Food. I'm hungry.
Tough, crone. You got any money?
Money.
Jake, this one's for outin'.
No money, huh?
The fry man moved away from the grill and around the stools.
Off your butt, Granny.
With difficulty, she unstooled herself.
Ugh, this one's ripe. You ever take a bath, old woman?
Go!
She caught herself, not quite certain what she had been about to say, except that it related to something obscene that would make him angry. Meanwhile, Jake had taken her scrawny arm. As she tried to make up her mind whether to struggle to even a token extent, Jake led her firmly out the back way. She was propelled out into a worse alley than the last. Here there were garbage cans and scrawny, flea-infested cats. He pointed to an open can where a large Tom was chewing at something burned or spoiled.
Your dinner, Grandma. Bon appetit.
They woke in the morning, stiff and sore from sleeping on the ground.
Where's Auntie John?
I want my breakfast. Me too.
They looked around, but Auntie was not to be seen.
Maybe she's hiding from us? Wearing an invisibility cloak?
Appleberries!
They breakfasted on the fruits and spring water. Then, as bravely as possible, they set about making plans. Rotternik lay before them, great trees, incredibly voracious wildlife, and people who had the reputation of not liking visitors. Auntie John had said that they would have to cross the border by themselves, but Merlane did not want to believe it. Now, she had to. Resolutely, they shouldered their packs, straightened their clothing, and took the never-to-be-taken-back step across the luminous green border. Past the great ugly gray stone with its pointing arrow, into the scary territory that was hidden by a deep ugly blackness, as if it lay in perpetual night, into the fabled forbidden kingdom of Rotternik.
I do wish that we could be birds again.
Me too.
Kildim promptly sat down at the side of the trail and opened the volume. Kildi, not to be outdone by his brother, got out his own stolen book and opened it. While Kildim read spell after spell to himself, Kildi was busily tracing lines on a map.
We have to go through all over the dreadful forest. That has to be it, straight ahead. Then we have to climb Heartbreak Mountain. That's in the distance. Then it's down the other side of the mountain and through or over Dismal Swamp. That brings us to Arpal. The border here looks like just an ordinary border on the map. Where do we come out in Arpal?
Kildi frowned more deeply and turned to another map.
We can come out on an island, or we can come out where there's water. That's all Arpal is. Water, islands, and land below water.
Merlane did not like the look of this at all. The forest, mountain, and swamp were bad enough, but land below water was worse. How would they breathe?
How far across is this kingdom?
Kildi measured with his fingers and a scale at the bottom of a map.
Can't really tell. Mountains at the bottom of this picture. Mountains high. Dreadful forest, maybe magical. Road through forest goes to capital. Barak.
Barak.
Like when you stick your tongue out. See for yourself.
Kildim did, then stuck his tongue out at Charles.
Barak.
Charles bristled. He looked as if he wanted to fight. His hand went for his sword.
Don't be stupid, Charles. We need them to read the spells and the maps. Also, you know someone may have to take some blame when we get back. Everything bad that happens will be their fault. Besides, you know how old they actually are. If you tried fighting them, you'd get hurt.
Not with this sword. It's magic. Auntie John said so.
Then you save your sword for the orc or something equally dangerous. You know I'm right.
The kinglets, quite oblivious to the conversation she was having with her brother or to Charles' menacing gesture, had their faces cheek to cheek so that they resembled one red-haired boy and one mirrored reflection.
I don't know, Kildom. If we fly straight across and nothing happens, maybe half a day, Kildi. But if we walk and if we climb the mountain...
After much arguing, the kinglets decided on the path through the dreadful forest. Dreadful Forest appeared even more dreadful as they walked through it. They had been walking for half a day. Merlane's feet hurt, and she was becoming bored. She wasn't sure which was worse. She was beginning to wish that something interesting would happen, even if it was a little threatening. Suddenly, Charles stopped walking and drew his sword.
What is it, Charles?
Straight ahead, in those bushes.
Merlane strained her eyes. Lights danced in them. She could make out some peculiarly bent branches in the bushes and an assortment of red eyes.
What?
I can see better than you, and I don't know what. I just know we don't want to get eaten by it.
Eaten?
Keldim! Keldi, in the bushes!
The kinglets responded like truly grown-up men, turned a significantly paler green, and ran for the trees. As they ran, a hairy branch-like thing reached out for Charles. Also, at that very moment, a hairy creature dropped from a higher to a lower branch. Merlane looked up at a face she would have preferred not to believe, a babki and a large one. But the forest dwellers were interested not in the children, but in the creature in the bush. One of them threw a chunk of tree bark, and then another threw a rotted tree branch. Soon, the air was filled with missiles raining down on and around the bush.
Charles, let's go!
But stupid Charles was liking his sword and his stance. He switched the blade as if he knew how to use it, ignoring the primates overhead.
Charles!
A big, bumpy thing rose from the bush. It was the bush, with legs that resembled brown and hairy branches. Many, many hairy legs, reaching feelers and red eyes. Marlene ran in terror. Marlene looked back to see the spider begin a scuttling charge. Missiles rained down on it. The spider's feelers batted away the missiles. The spider was fast, but Charles was faster. He was running now, finally convinced of the necessity. Maybe the spider would have been faster, but not when it had to keep knocking away the missiles. They might be no more than a distraction, but they did slow it down.
Help! Help!
Marlene looked back again and saw Charles coming hard. He looked breathless. She abruptly stopped running. Right in front of her was a long, damp slope. At his bottom, quite some distance ahead, the two royal canes were lying on their backs. Around them, heaped there, were the greenish skeletons and loose bones of animals. The royal canes were surrounded by skulls and arm bones and leg bones and... Charles had run into her, trying to look back. Now they were both tumbling, sliding, falling. Now... they were all stuck in this boneyard. The huge spider was crouched now at the mouth of this trap, which had taken so many of their kind, as well as four terrified children.
Oh, Charles! Oh, Kildim! Oh, Kildim!
Charles got himself untangled, climbed to his feet, and drew his sword. The sword looked like a toy. The huge spider crept down the slope they had just rolled down. Marlene saw now that the ground was coated with webbing, making it smooth, so that anything falling here would not be able to stop. It would also be hard to climb out. The spider's strategy was to drive its prey into this place where it could not escape.
I'm afraid. Oh, I'm so afraid.
But Charles clutched the hilt of his sword, and the sword seemed to give him courage. There was something about it, but no obvious magic.
I'll stop it. I have to stop it. I'll kill it! I have to!
Marlene watched her brother brandish his sword, and she knew that whatever magic it had was not going to help him, and that he was about to die. She knew that once that happened, there would be no help for the rest of them.
Auntie John!
Auntie John!
Auntie John!
But Auntie did not come, and Marlene thought the kingling stupid for thinking she might. A long, hairy foreleg darted at Charles. His sword shot out to meet it. The foreleg jerked back minus its tip. A drop of greenish substance dripped from it. Maybe Charles actually could fight the monster. Maybe the sword enhanced him so that he was fast enough and strong enough and skilled enough. Maybe. The foreleg darted a second time. Again, foreleg met blade, but this time not directly on. With one fast sweep, the spider whipped the sword expertly from Charles' hand. He was defenseless. A second leg grasped her brother. It yanked him off his feet, and he was slowly pulled toward the waiting mandibles of the monster.
Help him!
How they found the courage, she did not know, but Kildim and Kildee actually responded. Each boy grabbed one of Charles's legs. The spider pulled as they pulled. A tug of war was on. Marlene tried to help the boys, but their combined weight and strength was not enough. If only she weighed more. If only she had magic.
These creatures probably taste bad. I don't want to eat them.
Something had to be magic. That book, that had to be the answer. But she didn't have time to read it, even if she could understand what was in it. And the screaming kinglets were no good for that at this stage. There had to be something else.
The Alice water.
Maybe that was it. The straining spider's limb pulled all three closer to the opening and closing mandibles with their dripping drops of digested liquid. Marlene would be the last one to be eaten, but that was small comfort. She had to try. It was the only thing. Quickly, she took out the small bottle from her pack. She brought the bottle to her face and unstoppered it with her teeth. Not giving herself a chance to think, she turned it up and took more of a sip than she had intended. Nothing happened. Except that something seemed to slip away from one hand. Disappointed, she replaced the stopper, though it seemed pointless to save unmagical water. She looked around and saw that the spider and children were gone. So were the trees. There was shoulder-high shrubbery all around. Tiny bugs scuttled in it. She looked down at her feet, and she was standing in a shallow hole. Two little chimps pulled at a third, but all were dressed as humans. Right at the edge of the hole, holding on to the brown-suited chimp, was a spider. Suddenly, she understood the situation. Merlaine hardly thought at all. A spider was a spider, and one this size she could handle as she would at home. Suddenly, she moved it over the group, then over the spider, centering the heel of her boot above its body. She lowered her foot. The spider, no dummy, scrambled back out of the way. The three boys tumbled heels over heads in the other direction. The little fleas swarmed through the brush, actually the trees, to pursue the spider in its retreat.
Merlaine! You're big!
I know that!
The water hadn't made her small. It had made her a giant. That had certainly solved their problem with the spider. She looked around again. That rough rise a short distance away was the mountain they had been traveling to. She could carry them all in a few steps. That would be better than being a bird. But she'd have to hurry. The magic had a way of wearing off. She leaned down and put her hand out in front of them. Charles ran and got his sword, and in a moment, he and the two kinglets climbed on.
Well, Charles, I know what it is to have three boys on my hands.